Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you. Time, energy, and willingness to sit down and listen. On today's episode, I have Mr. Aaron Walker. Aaron is a serial entrepreneur, made his first millions by late 20s, retired, had some personal issues which he'll talk about, and back in the horse race again. Aaron also is huge into mastermind groups, but more importantly, we are here to talk about his book, A View from the Top, which is an autobiographical, basically, story of his life, learnings he has, and wants to give you for yourself. What will come clear in this is that his personal life, his family, and his faith come first. So have a listen to that. Also, everyone, you will be tired of hearing me prostitute out my book coming out. I know I said the fall, now it is spring, but it will be spring and it will not move from spring no matter what. And you can be part of the process. So go to my website, Dr. James Kelly, KELLEY.com. Go to the book section, fill out the form, and you can help me edit the book. Be part of the process, and I will give you a free book. All right, I want to say thank you to my content partners, C-Suite Radio, Transformation Radio, Engage Me, and please leave a review on iTunes. My time is running out. All right, have a lovely week, everybody. I appreciate your time and energy as always. See you.
Good man, things are good here. No complaints. How about in Dubai?
Dubai is busy as always. So, Aaron, I know that you are through the roof busy with your 12,000 projects that you have going on at all times. But I really appreciate you taking, you know, an hour out of your hectic schedule to sit down and chat with me. As you know, this whole podcast is about your journey. Mm-hmm. What you do is interesting to me, but who you are is, for me, the icing on the cake. So just for my audience gets a bit of a 10,000 view, even figured out, I just kind of jump right into this. So my audience gets a 10,000 foot view. Can you give us an idea of who you are? Why am I talking to you? And why are you the coolest man in Tennessee?
Well, I don't know about that last statement, but I'll give you the 30,000 foot view. So here's the deal. I don't want to make it too much about me, just to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I want to really make it about your audience because that's why they listen to this. They don't listen to this so that they can rave about what I'm doing and about who I am. But to give you context of who I am, if you'll allow me to share the 30,000 foot view, I think it'll be helpful.
Sure.
So I started out in Nashville. That's where I'm from, Nashville, Tennessee. I've been here 56 years. There's not many of us left in Nashville any longer. But I'm a native to here. I love it in Nashville. People ask me if you could live anywhere that you could. I say, well, I can. And I am. I can live anywhere I want. And I'm living where I want. And that's Nashville, Tennessee. It's beautiful here.
So what about it do you love? Like, what about it do you love?
Yeah, well, there's four distinct seasons, first of all. Second of all, it's within a seven-hour drive of 75% of the national population. I can be at the beach in 6 hours in two different directions. There's three major interstates that run through here. It's a mecca for the entrepreneurs. It used to be all about country music. Now it's about medical and entrepreneurs. And we've developed an entrepreneur center here. Some of the wealthiest people in our state have contributed the money. It costs very little to belong there. It was a genius idea because now it's an incubator, you know, for entrepreneurs, and they're developing new businesses, and they're bringing people from all over the world to Nashville. As a result of that, our economy is booming. Housing is bursting at the seams. There's absolutely anything you could want here. The weather is good. It's not too cold. It's not too hot. And so I could go on for the rest of the interview, but that's just a few highlights. That's why I love it, Dr. Kelly, right here in Nashville, Tennessee. Back to my story. So at 13 years old, I started working for a local pawn shop, which is a place to borrow money. At 18, fell in love with the business, found two partners. We started our own because I didn't have any money. I needed a partner. I came from a very, very broke family. We didn't have anything. We had a lot of character. We had high moral values, but we had no money because my dad was not a good businessman. We lived in a $6,500 house, you know, so I know about being poor, and we later lost it in bankruptcy. Moved in with my cousin when I was a child, rented a house after that, and I lived there till I graduated. But so I've got strong work ethic, but I just didn't have a formal education in business. So I met these two guys. We opened our own 7 years, four stores, 9 years into the process, we sold out to a Fortune 500 company, and I was through at 27 years old. And everybody says, oh man, that is amazing. Well, it was. I mean, it was cool. I don't want to discount it. But the
truth
is,
how bored did you get?
Just fixing to tell you, is 18 months later, I'm getting in the bed in the middle of the day. My wife woke me up and she said, you're getting fat and lazy. You've gained 50 pounds. You've been at home 18 months and this is not what I signed up for. So I go back, buy the company that I started with when I was 13 years old. We spent the next 10 years really crushing it. We quadrupled that business in 10 years. And then, Dr. Kelly, my life changed forever. August 1st, 2001, really hot in Nashville. It's the humid time of the year. Got the air up, full blast, got the radio on. Things are good. I'm headed to work. And a guy named Enrique was crossing the street to catch a local bus to go into Nashville, and he didn't look my way, and he walked out in front of me, and I ran over and killed a pedestrian. And man, you talking about bringing your life to a screeching halt. Mine came to an abrupt halt that day. So I won't take you through all the gory details, but the truth of the matter is it rocked my world. Enrique lived for 3 days in the Vanderbilt trauma unit. They called me on that Saturday morning, and they said, hey man, sorry to give you this news, he didn't make it. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, things are so good. I'm 40 years old at the time. I've got two beautiful daughters. We got all the stuff. And we did. We had the stuff. I've got a place, condo with some buddies down on the beach. And we've got the stuff. But here's what I came to realize through that. My legacy would have been what you just heard. Poor kid, comes from nothing, makes some money, retires at 27. Nobody cares but his family. And I felt really guilty about that. And I started thinking about it.
So can I ask you why? So, Aaron, you got to let me ask questions, man, or this is going to be no fun for me. I got to ask you questions.
You're the host.
So tell me about this guilt that you felt. Like, clearly this is a linchpin in your life, as it should be with anybody in their life, that situation. So you're at the top of the mountain. You are singing the praises of the world you're living in. You have everything you've wanted, especially coming from where you started. And you had this horrific event. What was this guilt wrapped up in?
Well, what I was doing was focusing 100% of my effort and energy on me, right? More stores, more money. Now, don't hear me wrong, Dr. Kelly. There's nothing wrong with making money. I love to make money. I want to make more money. But I don't want money to own me. Mm-hmm. And see, it was beginning to do that. It was like another store, another X thousand dollars, another car, get a place here, get a place there. And here's what I've discovered through this process, and I'd like to dive into this pretty deep if we could. It's okay to have that stuff, but see, we've got it backwards. We don't live to work. We work so that we can live. Mm-hmm. And most people have that backwards. Most people get up every day to go make more money to foster a better lifestyle for themselves. And so they spend very little time looking outward. And that's what I discovered through that wreck. I sold my business and I retired. I said, I'm done. Well, a couple of my mastermind members later challenged me on that, but I took 5 years off. I didn't do anything. We traveled, we built a new house, kind of had to change the landscape a little bit. And one day I thought, you know what it is I'm missing? I'm missing significance. I've got the stuff and nobody cares but me. And I'm not making a difference in other people's lives. All I'm making a difference in is my family's life. And quite honestly, the new stuff was fun for a period of time, but it really doesn't scratch the itch like we think it's going to. We think, when I get this money, then I'll be satisfied. When I get this new business, right? And it's just not the way it is. I'm just telling you, 38 years now I've been doing this. I've owned 12 businesses, and I've been to the top. You know, it's not what you think. Here's what is important.
But can I ask you a quick question, though? Like,
You don't have to ask permission. It's your show, so come on.
So, what I think for me is a really fascinating part of this story is you talk about money was starting to own you, and you're opening one store after another store. And we don't have to dive too much into your family because I know it's fairly private to you, but. Were you doing that in the behest of your family? Like, were you work first, family second at that point?
Yeah, here's what was going on, and it almost cost me my family because I'm an aggressive person. I'm a go-getter. I'm a high D on the DISC profile. I mean, I'll go, I hammer down. I'm ready. I'm even like that now, right? Yeah. Well, here's what I discovered through this whole process because I've gone to counseling. You know, I've hired people. I've got coaches. I've done all that. The good thing is that I was successful. The bad thing is that I was successful. Because here's what happens as a result of that. When you're successful, you'll work twice as hard to maintain that status. Right? Because you don't want to feel inadequate. See, that's what's driving us. We want to feel adequate.
Did you feel like you were in an arms race? Like you were in an arms race with your friends and your peers?
No, it wasn't my friend. No, it wasn't any of my peers or friends. Mm-hmm. It was me. I was going to prove that I could do this.
And that comes from your childhood, obviously.
Sure. Because what I was, running from something, not to something. And that's really important to really figure that out about yourself. And what I didn't want to do is live like my dad had lived. Physically, I watched him sweep the snow off of roofs in the winter and re-roof the house so that we would have money to buy groceries. And I watched my mom put canned goods in the pantry and nail a board over it during the summer so in the winter we would have something to eat. And I'm like, I don't want that. I don't physically want to work that hard. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew what I didn't want. And so I gave everything I had to making a better life for myself. I wasn't a bad husband. I was a good husband. I was a good dad. But my total soul focus was on acquiring more stuff, getting secure financially. That was my sole focus. Now, there again, I don't want the listeners to misunderstand what I'm saying. You should. It's incumbent on us to provide a safe environment for our family, to provide security. I think we should do all those things. But there's got to be an element of your life that is significant to others. You weren't placed here just for yourself. And that's the part I was missing.
Well, and I think, you know, I can totally relate to your story there. You know, I still feel like I'm in that race of, I don't know if it's running. Someone actually said that to me in my 20s. What are you running from? Because I had moved two different countries at this point, and it was actually my sister-in-law. She's like, what are you running from? And I said, why does it have to be from? Why couldn't it be two? But the question I always had is, I'm not really sure what that two is. For me, for you, it was like getting wealth and money was kind of the thing you were consuming at one point in your life. And this, again, I agree with you. It's not a bad thing. It's not a judgment or on values. For me, it was education. And I thought once I got all this education, I'd have worth or value. But it doesn't really mean anything to anyone else but myself. So then what was that about? And then now the next day, I'm on this next track of and it's funny because ever since I met you and Neil and this little tiny group, Tom, it's really struck me, and I've been thinking about it for a while, this idea of, to what you were just talking about the more, the doing for others with no expectations of it coming back to you, because when you do it with no expectations, it does come back to you.
That's the whole thing, that I'm beating that drum every single day, and I can prove it to be true over and over and over. And there again, you read books and you say, well, that's what they say. Well, you're listening to somebody that's been there, done that almost four decades now. So what I'm saying is this strategic method works, but when you do it for the wrong reason, it doesn't. But when you do it for the right reason, it does. And that's looking outward and giving. And we teach it ongoing. My friend John John Ruhlin wrote a book called Giftology, and he teaches you how to gift people things that mean something to them, not a promotion for you, but to them. Well, we do that through all kind of measures. You know, we do that through video. We do that through emails. We do through promoting other people. We spend 20-25% of our day promoting other people just because we feel it's the right thing to do when we believe in it. The natural reciprocity out of that, Dr. Kelly, it comes back by the bucket loads, right?
I mean, how do you not think? So my this is my skeptic side, I guess. And again, I'm for it. So this is like devil's advocate, right? And I think you're probably way savvy, so you would see this coming a mile away. But how do you know when people aren't trying to take advantage of that?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There's always going to be people to take advantage of everything. People oftentimes say, I don't give money to those people on the streets because they're going to take the money and they're going to go down there and buy a bottle of booze and they're going to do the wrong. Why don't they get a job? Well, first of all, it's incumbent on us to give, right? Generosity, we should. There's always people going to take advantage of you. Just know it's the cost of doing business. It just happens, right?
I like that.
So what we do is that I'm a Christian by faith, and so I pray for God's direction in my life. And when I feel led to do things, I do it. The responsibility is then on them, what they do with it. Mm-hmm. One of my buddies told me at church recently, he said, I'm not going to give to the church anymore because they're not doing this or that. And I said, you know, our scripture teaches us to give. It doesn't have a caveat or an addendum that says, if they're doing with it what you think they should, you should go find another church if you can't go along with what they're doing. We're supposed to give, period. It's the same way in the world today. Now, a lot of people will go, well, that feels manipulative, you know. And listen, I think we use that as an excuse not to give. Because it's difficult oftentimes, and it takes time. And we do it with a lot of things outside of money, and we also do it a lot anonymously, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's about us, and we know that we're doing it for the right reason. It's not to be manipulative, and it's not to get something out of somebody. There are two kind of people in the world. Adam Grant wrote a book called Givers and Takers. Mm-hmm. You're one or the other. If you're listening to my voice, now here's what people will say oftentimes to me through an email. I do a lot of interviews, and people write me back, well, if I had the kind of money you do, I would give too. Now, hold on, because I'm going to lose some of you right here. My reply to that always is, here's my reply, no, you wouldn't. Yeah. And let me tell you why you wouldn't, because money magnifies what's in the heart. It doesn't change it.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. You don't need money to give.
No, because here's the thing. It's about the heart. It's not about the money. It's about the heart. Now, can I do some things that maybe some listeners can't do? Well, maybe I can, but that's beside the point. The thing is it doesn't cost anything to give words of affirmation. It doesn't cost anything to write an email. It doesn't cost anything to promote Dr. James Kelly. It doesn't cost anything to give. You can give that's far more greater value than monetarily speaking.
Well, and what you're talking about is choice, right? You have a choice to make. Yes. You know, so we talk about givers or takers, but that's a choice, right? So, yeah, I was recently, I recently interviewed Mo Gadot, which was an awesome interview, who's the chief business officer of Google. He just wrote the book Solve for Happy. And he basically says there's two constants in life. It's change in your attitude or how you respond, your choice of attitude, right? Yeah. And he's like, those are the two sure things you know, how you're going to respond to something, your attitude towards it, and change. And to me, that boils down to choice making. Like, I'm going to choose to be happy. I'm going to choose to give. I'm going to choose to whatever.
Happiness is a choice. It's not a trait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the same way. The only thing we're in 100% control over, the only thing, is your attitude.
Yeah.
Nothing else you're in control over. Well, are you the half full or half empty guy?
Yeah, it's funny. I made a conscious effort. I really grew up in a house where we were definitely lower middle class, not poverty. It sounds like you were more poverty than myself. But, you know, I grew up in a house where my mom every day for 15 years would come home and complain about her job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this is where I relate to you, right? So you grew up in this house where eating was a luxury almost, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least eating nice. And you made a conscious choice early on to run from that as fast as possible to be different than that. And my mom for 15 years complained about her job every day. And that conscious and non-conscious queuing has driven me to make sure that whatever I do, for whether it's 12 months, 12 years, I have to be happy doing it. I'm not going to spend my time. And again, not every job is roses, and I get that. There's always the stink to a job. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you, for me at least, I have to be doing something that I'm actively engaged with that I'm either passionate about or at least really happy to show up and do it every single time for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. The opposite in my house was my mom never complained, ever, even in light of our circumstances. And she had a saying. She would always encourage us to try something. She would say, she wouldn't allow us to say the word can't. Mm-hmm. She would say, you might not be able to do it, but you're going to try. And she would force us, push us through those upper limit challenges. There was even a little saying that she had. It was can't, couldn't do it, but could did it all. And I have adopted that as my life mantra. Everything I do now, I run it through that filter. It's like, hey, Avery, can you do this? Yes, I can. What is it you want me to do? I have that mentality, that mindset. Carol Dweck writes about it in her book, Mindset. Growth. We've either got a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. I do not want a fixed mindset. I don't want to say it's just the way it is. You've got, you know, we were talking one day and there was a family member I've got, and I told him, I said, well, you know, you need to do this. And he said, well, it's just the way I am. I said, well, you need to change because nobody likes you. You need to change the way you're doing this. See, it's a choice. We can't change our personality, right? But we can change our behavior.
I would love to be in that room when you said that to him and watch the eyes get really big. Everyone around the room. Unless you're probably known as the guy who's the I imagine you're like the truth teller in the family, though. Like, if anyone wants the honesty, they go to Aaron.
Well, they call me Frank. I don't know if that's good or bad. But here's the thing. Let's don't take pride in that. Let's don't boast in that. But you can't help somebody unless you're telling them the truth. And that's the reason I've been in mastermind groups for 20 years. Is because I want to surround myself with people like you that tell me the truth. And I tell everybody, if you want to feel warm and fuzzy, go buy yourself a puppy. Yeah. But if you want to really grow, you've got to get people around you that'll tell you the truth. I invite constructive criticism. I literally write notes to people and say, how do you see me in these 10 areas? And I invite people to tell me. I say, I can take it on the chin. Give it to me. Whatever you got, I want to get better. I don't want you to make me feel good. I want you to make me better. Mm-hmm. And when they don't have anything to gain or lose as a result of their answer, they're going to tell you the truth. And you've got to invite that constructive criticism. You've got to be willing to subject yourself to the scrutiny of other people.
Why do you think people have such a hard time with that?
Well, because everybody wants to be liked. Mm-hmm. See, here's the thing. You think, I'm not saying you do, but I'm just saying listeners think, hey, if they know the truth about me, they may not like me. Or if I tell them the truth, it's like, hey, man, listen, I love you and all, but here's the deal. This is the truth. Here's what I hate. I hate this worse than anything. I've led numbers of companies. I've led numbers of meetings, and I was head of a 12-person committee at our church, and I went in. I was leading the meeting, and it got ugly. I mean, it was like, hey, say what you got to say right here because we're making the decisions for a 7,000-member congregation. You got to say what you want to say. So the meeting gets over. I go out to the parking lot. I'm getting in my car, and somebody walks up to me and says, hey, I got to tell you something. I said, no, you're not. I'm not going to listen to it. You got to be able to lay them up on the table in there, in that room, where everybody can make a choice. Out here, it's gossip. In there, it's helping. And sorry. And I got the car and left. But what I'm saying is see, we've got to have the courage to tell people the truth. There was a guy named James Ryle that was a speaker, traveled all over the world. He was in a mastermind group with me. Dave Ramsey invited me, you know, decades ago to be in his mastermind group. Ken Abraham's in there. He's got 115 books in print. This guy's amazing. Dan Miller, 48 Days to the Work You Love. James Ryle. All these guys are amazing. Everybody says, oh, yeah, I'd love to be in that too. Well, they weren't 2 decades ago the people they are now. See, they are the people they are now because they invested 2 decades of surrounding themselves with people that tell them the truth. So I'm in this dark spot. James, I mean, I'm telling you, I'm in a dark spot in my life. I couldn't get over it. I don't know if you've ever been there or not, but I couldn't shake it. I just couldn't get over it. I got a phone call from James Ryle.
Was this after the pedestrian
accident? Yeah, this is after the accident, yeah. So I couldn't get out of this. It wasn't related to that, quite honestly, but it was something else. But I just couldn't shake this thing. It'd take too long to explain it. We don't have enough time. But anyway, it was a dark spot. So I get a phone call from James, and I look at my phone, and it was on a weekend. And I said, this is going to be really good or really bad. I don't know which, because we never bother each other on the weekends. We respect the privacy for our families. So I answered it, and he said, hey, Aaron, this is James. And I said, yeah, James, what is it? He said, well, I was praying for you this morning. God gave me a word for you. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is going to be awesome, because this guy can almost walk on water. I mean, this guy's amazing. I said, hold on, let me go outside so I can hear you. Walked outside in the parking lot at a hardware store, and I said, yeah, go ahead. He said, you're wearing the hell out of everybody in our group. And I just sat there, and I started laughing, and I said, really, what? He goes, no, really. We are so sick and tired of hearing this. You talk about it relentlessly. You go on and on and on. You're in a ditch, man. It's like a grave. It's got both ends kicked out. You just stay there on and on and on. He said, I was reading a scripture in Isaiah this morning. It said, take the chains from around your neck and let's move on. He said, it's time you were moving on. He said, I see you. I got to go. And hung up. Well, there I stood in the parking lot of the hardware store, and I could have bit a nail in two. I was so mad. And then I thought, you know what? This guy has spent a decade with me, and he loves me enough to tell me the truth. Mm-hmm. And here's what happened. I changed. The next Wednesday, I went in Dave's office and went up to these guys and hugged them and apologized. And I said, I'm sorry. I needed that, right? Sometimes we need a nudge. Yeah. Sometimes we need to be pushed off the bluff. He pushed me off the bluff. But it changed my life. It got me up and going. Well, here's the thing. You've got to have people around you to help you, because the enemy to excellence is isolation. Mm-hmm. Right? It's and so, so you've got to let that veil down. Be authentic. Be genuine. People will help you.
So there's this, obviously there's a clear theme for you in terms of one of your pillars in your life, and that's your Christianity. Have you always been Christian, or is this something you came to later on?
I accepted Christ when I was 9 years old. It was in August of 1970. And wow. My mom and dad, that is something that they have poured into me. They didn't have any money, but they had a lot of faith. Mm-hmm. And so they really taught us about values, being a person of character, high moral values. When you shake a man's hand, it's done. Be honest. Mm-hmm. They introduced me to Christ, and I accepted Christ, and I've lived for Christ since I was 9 years old. I'm 56 now. Best decision I've ever made in my entire life.
Wow. I'm always impressed when I meet people who have unwavering faith. So, I mean, is your throughout everything, throughout the accident, business, life, has it ever wavered? Or has it always been this steady North Star for you?
Well, it's always been the cornerstone for me, always, because mm-hmm. We live our life to bring Christ glory and honor. That's the sole purpose, right? He's a selfish God. I mean, he wants the glory. No matter what happens to me as an individual, he has a plan for my life, and I know that. And sometimes it's what I want, sometimes it's not. But that's the reason I've had the unwavering faith, is because I know he knows best. I know ultimately there's going to be a reason for this, and I hold on to my faith. It gives me a great sense of contentment. Mm. A lot of people, though, they feel this distant contentment. They have a sense of there's always more. They're grappling for something. And my identity is placed in Christ. And when you place your identity in tangible possessions, or you place it in you know, money, or you place it in titles, or you place it, that can come and go. And then does that mean you're nothing, right? You lose your job, you lose your money. Does that mean? But see, for me, my identity is in Christ, so that never wavers. And so I can relax, and I can live the life of another, which is Christ. And so then I can go about my life.
But what I think, though, to me is, at least based on what you said earlier, is that in your 20s and 30s, that wasn't in alignment, because you were driving so hard for money.
My faith never wavered, but my priorities were misaligned, right? So it had nothing to do with my faith and confidence in Christ. It's just that my behavior was askew. My behavior was not in alignment. My priorities were wrong. And my priorities now today, as a result of that automobile accident, it got my attention, is my faith is first, my wife is second, my children, then my grandchildren. I have 5 beautiful grandchildren. And then my business, mm-hmm. and then my relationships. And so there's not a such thing as work-life balance, It's just not. We have to prioritize our priorities. You have to put the big rocks in first, right? I want to devote my time and attention to these things. People say, I don't have time to do what I want. Well, then your priorities are confused. Mm-hmm. Because here's what we say. We say that's important, but we do what is important. So you can say whatever you want. Yeah. It doesn't matter to me what you say. Your actions are screaming at me, right? That's what's important to you.
Doesn't that drive you mad? Like, that's one of my biggest pet peeves. Maybe it's a bit harsh, but I'm a big believer in what you say doesn't matter if your actions don't back it up. So you can tell me that you're going to solve some sort of disease, but until you do it, you know, maybe that's a bad example, but I think you get the gist of what I'm trying to say is that so many people will say something. I'll use my mom as a great example. You know, she recently, and I love my mom. She's 73. She's had not the hardest life, but definitely not an easy life. Lost, you know, married once, divorced, married my father. He passed away almost 20 years ago now. Yeah, geez, over 20 years ago. And she's just never been right. She's just bad choices, financial, eating, health, just all bad choices. And so, you know, my kids, I procreated in about a 4-month period. So all my kids' birthdays are between March and May. I have 4 kids. And she said, oh, I'm gonna put some money in your account and buy these gifts. No money comes. Mm-hmm. And I've said to her, I mean, so many times, Mom, if you can't afford it, we don't care. It's not about the present. It's about the relationship with you. Just take the time. Like, that's all the kids want. And so it's one of those where you get to a point with people when they say something, don't do something, that bond or trust is broken. And now, and I don't know how you deal with this, but for me, I tend to just pull away from them because I see them as being unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I very, very strategically pick my friends. Mm-hmm. And when we go down the path you're just talking about, I get away from that. And the reason, because I want people around my children and my grandchildren that's going to edify them, encourage them, teach them values, have core values that they show them. And you surround the people because Jim Rohn said it best, you are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. And so I don't want to be around the naysayers. I don't want to be around the people that are telling me one thing and doing another. A buddy of mine told his dad recently, he said, hey, sorry I hadn't, you know, got over to see my grandmother. I'm going to go see her. She's important to me. And his dad stopped him and said, no, she's not. And yeah, Nana's important to me. No, she's not. Because if she was, you would go see her. See, what's important to you is your work. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason you're working 12 hours a day instead of seeing your grandmother. So quit saying that. Well, that's true for all of us that's listening to this. Your actions show what you prioritize.
So I'm probably guilty of it sometimes myself, and I probably am guilty with it in terms of with my mom, you know. It's definitely a learned behavior, but I definitely am. So I guess my point is, are you ever guilty of doing that yourself, or are you so conscious of that?
Yeah. No. I'm human. We're all human. Mm-hmm. I'm not casting stones here. We're all guilty. That's the reason I have mastermind members. That's the reason now for almost 3 decades, I have an accountability group that I meet with every Friday morning. The group I've got now, we've been meeting over 10 years. Every Friday morning, 3 guys, Randy, Hugh, and Chris, and we meet every Friday morning for an hour, hour and a half, and we hold each other accountable for doing the right things. See, it's what I told you earlier. We have to have immense accountability in our lives. Otherwise, we'll push it off to the side, and we'll get to it later. Later never comes. Same way with things that we look at, things that we see, people that we say bad things to. When we travel, we do things that we would do not when you're with your family. See, I want one Dr. James Kelly to show up in every conversation, whether it be with your children, your wife, your peers, your colleagues, your friends, your family, alone, right? I want the same guy to show up because it's exhausting living the double life. Right, you can look at these things, do these things, and drink these things, and smoke these things, as long as these people don't know about it. See, that's exhausting to me.
Yeah, no, it's exhausting. I don't want to do that. It's exhausting for me to think about. I think 4 years, but I think for each person. So yes, I totally am about authenticity all the way. There is probably a 10 or 15% variance in my behavior if I'm around my kids versus my wife. You know what I mean? There's certain things I would say in front of my wife, not my kids. Standard etiquette stuff that is more acceptable. But sure. For me, and it sounds like for you, like I am what you see. Like there's no mistaking that I wear my thoughts and feelings, and not in a destructive way. I think it's in a constructive way, but not everyone always takes it that way. So here's the thing.
You can't be condescending. I don't want to ever be condescending. I don't want to ever be judgmental. I don't want to ever be any of those things to anybody. But I will say this truthfully. I can't say it's always been that way. Early on in my life, I wanted to impress people. I wanted Dr. James Kelly to know I knew certain people. It was a pride thing. It was an ego thing. And I've learned, though, as a result of having your priorities in place, having your identity tied up in the right thing, you don't need to do those things. And so I'm with you the same as I am when I hang up, and I'm with both my daughters here at my office. They both work here in the office. When I go home, I'm the same with Robin. When I travel out of town, I watch the same things on the TV, right? If Robin was sitting there, when I'm typing my emails, she can come in here and look at my history on anything. I want to be the same person. The other way, you always got to be worried. Do they know this? Did they see me do this? If they find this out, what will happen? See, you lose your character. See, it's a character flaw. So I'm saying it's just much easier this way. Just identify who you are and live that way and be that person.
I often wonder, and I would never do this, and I'm not planning I would, but how someone could cheat and have a double life. Because to your point, man, it would be exhausting and complicated. And
it's done every day, though. 55% of the marriages end in divorce. 67% of divorces have the word Facebook in the divorce decree. Right? We get in trouble. We start watching things. Listen, I have built boundaries. I'm not perfect. I want to tell you a few things that I've done personally, though. This is just me. I'm not suggesting that anybody listening to this interview needs to do this. I'm not suggesting that. But just to give you an example of some of the things that we've done here, I coach men. No disrespect to women. It's just that I know men. I am one, right? 56 years. I know men. I know how to motivate them. I know what to say. I'll say the hard things. And so I don't coach women. Well, as a result of that, in my social media, I don't need to follow women. I don't need to talk to women. When I'm traveling out of town, I go speak or I'm at a book signing. Women come up to me all the time. Hey, can I get a selfie with you? No. And let me tell you why. And they look at me like I got two heads. You know, like, what are you saying? I say, I've got a wife sitting at home on the couch in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm in San Diego, and I got this beautiful blonde girl, 25 years old, in a picture. You're going to take that picture and immediately you're going to post it on Facebook. And then my wife's sitting at home going, wow, that don't make me feel comfortable, right? See, I love my wife enough to put the boundaries up to protect our relationship, because we've been married 37 years and I want to be married 30 more years. And I want to do whatever it takes to protect my relationship. I don't send emails to women without copying my assistant. My assistant is my daughter. Right? Mm-hmm. I have strong boundaries. Never go to lunch. I don't talk to women alone. I don't do those things because I want to protect. That's just one example of many boundaries that we need to be in place. The reason, Dr. Kelly, is I have prioritized in my life what's important. And when you stick to that, listen, when I explain to women and tell them the reason, they're like, man, I wish my husband would do that. I'm so respect you as a result of that. I've never had a person, not once in all of my travels, to say, that's insane. Not one person. And see, it just shows great honor for Robin, my wife.
So talk quickly. I mean, a couple of questions, then we're going to do my the fast five, which are five random questions. And then I want to talk about your book that's coming out in, I think, like 3-4 weeks.
Yeah, man, it's right here on us. Yeah. I'm pretty fired up. I want to talk about that for a couple minutes because this book is absolutely gaining some traction. I'm pretty fired up about it.
So Robin clearly is this. She's your life partner. So how did you meet Robin, and what role does she play in your life on a daily basis? Which your response is going to be like everything, but.
Well, here's the thing. Robin and I live geographically around, you know, pretty close to the same place. We went to rivalry high schools. And so I met her, all the teenagers hang out at this one restaurant when I was a teenager. That was a long time ago. That was in the 70s. And Robin was 16 years old. I was 17 when I met her. And it was kind of cool. You know, we started dating, and next thing you know, one thing went to another. I started a business. And then we got married. Robin was 18, 2 weeks out of high school. I was 19 when we got married. She worked in the business. She's been with me since day one. She's my biggest advocate, my biggest supporter. Absolutely the cornerstone, the foundation, absolutely to what we're doing. She's my biggest supporter. We talk about everything completely. And, you know, it's not always, you know, we've had our ups and downs. I would be lying. You know, we've had challenges. You be married 37, 38 years, you'll have your challenges too. We're two different people. But the truth is we made a commitment and we're going to stick to our commitment. So she's everything. I mean, that's it. Matter of fact, the book that I wrote, I dedicated the book to her, and I get a little paragraph in the book about it's all because of her. And so, yeah, she's my biggest advocate.
That's awesome. I'm going on 10 years, so I guess next month, so June. So
which, June what? June what?
June 23rd.
Mine's 21st.
Oh, so close.
Yeah, be 37 years for us, June 21st.
I mean, it goes, I mean, I honestly cannot believe how fast it's gone. So I can only imagine for you that it's, like, it's like being in a Star Trek movie and you're in warp speed.
Yeah, it is. It goes faster. You know, you've always heard that, and it's true. You know, God has blessed us with two daughters. I have a daughter that's 34. One is 31. And then we have five grandchildren that's 18 months old up to almost 15 years old. And I'm getting the privilege of helping teach my granddaughter how to drive now. So it happens quickly. Hey, you'll snap your fingers, Dr. Kelly, and turn around, and you'll go, oh, my goodness, where did time go?
I feel like that now. I mean, it's amazing. And I always think that, as you obviously know, parenting is this consistent evolution of phases that you adapt, the kids adapt, you know, you and your wife adapt, and it's never dull with four kids, I can tell you that.
You know, I want to say one more thing about this before we end the interview. I do want to, and when you said something, it really prompted something in my spirit to share this. You can always do another deal. You can always send another email. You can always do another whatever conference. You can always make more money, always. The office doesn't have a memory. Right. You can make more money. You can sell businesses. But I don't want you to come home with a pocket full of money one day to a house full of strangers. I want you to know what your little girl's teacher's name is and what her favorite color is and what she wants to do. And I wrote a post recently and it was called Daddy, Can We Play? And the thing is used to you would spell love, T-I-M-E. But today it's just, can I get your attention? Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you, never, ever, ever forsake the desires of your family. It's incumbent on us as dads to be there and be the husband that God called you to be for your wife and the dad for your children, because nobody else can fill that role but you. Money can come and go, but you only got one shot with that family.
I can't agree more. For me, the complications is that I'm early in my career. I say that sounds not awful. It sounds kind of sad comparing to you sold your first company at 27, but I'm 42, and I think I've finally have figured out what I'm best at and passionate about. So I'm driving as hard as I can because I feel like my window to create financial stability, and I don't mean Warren Buffett style money, I just mean comfortable money, is closes in my mind by 49, because that's when my dad died. So that's my internal clock ticking. But I am always home at, well, always like 98% of the time home at 5. Dinner. I took my son to soccer tonight. I try to be, when I'm here, I'm here. When I'm working, I work. So like with my podcast, most of my interviews are after the kids go to bed. And, you know, I have a really cool wife. She really understands what I'm trying to accomplish right now and is very supportive. And she's very physically active. She's a triathlon coach. And I support her training and help watch the kids. I watch the kids while she trains, give her the freedom and remove the guilt for her to do that. And so we have a very good mutual relationship that we both have goals we're trying to achieve in different ways. And as long as we can help each other and be there for the kids. And she's, I mean, she comes from an amazing family, an amazing mom. I couldn't pick a better mom for my kids at all. Like there's literally, I could not. So I'm very, very, very blessed for that.
I hope you tell her that often because you need to. If you don't, and you said something that I want to mention, that Dr. Clark Gaither, a guy that's in Mastermind with me, gave an interesting statistic. And when you said something, it triggered it in me. Robin, my wife, did this for our family. She always was a stay-at-home mom. Most important job in our family was taking care of our home and our children. My hat's off to her. Every night, she had dinner for us on the table. We didn't sit in front of the TV. No electronics were allowed there. We talked as a family. She normally lit a candle on the table almost every night. Not every night, but almost every night. We always ate together as a family. Dr. Clark Gaither told us recently that that statistic has been released that says that families that eat together is the number one prohibitive thing for, listen, for kids not having premarital sex. The reason is because they have a family that they can share with. See, they don't even know and realize what they're doing. They're starving to death for attention because we're not giving it to them as a family. So listen, guys, start today. If you're hearing this interview, do whatever you've got to do to prioritize your priorities. Start eating dinner with your family, making them number one in your life.
Yeah, I'm always astonished when people, you know, there's a person I used to work with, and she indicated that they never ate as a family. And she loves her family. She's really great. But they literally never had dinner as a family. She said she couldn't remember the last. And I just found that, like, just mind-blowing to me.
That sounds sad to me.
Yeah, it was a little bit sad. So, listen, we need to do Fast Five and then talk about the book. All right. So, you ready to play Fast Five? The answer is yes. So, here we go. All right. Question one, what was your first job ever? Which I know you've told me, but for the record, state it again.
Yeah, I worked at a local pawn shop, Barry's Jewelry and Loan Company.
Awesome. And obviously what you learned is that if you do that for a long period of time, you could become successful. So
there you go.
All right. Question two. What animal best represents your management style?
Oh, my goodness. I should have prepared for these. I'm a gazelle. I'm 180 miles an hour. Pedal to the metal, throttle down, you know, 18 hours a day. I'm a hard charger. I believe in relaxing, and I believe in working, and they're two distinct different things, and so that's my management style.
So who's the lion in that? Who's hunting you?
I don't know.
All right. Question three. What trait in your colleagues most annoys you?
Indecision. Oh, my goodness. Make a decision. Like, I'm like, oh, my gosh, are you serious? You're not paying a mortgage on this meal that you're ordering. Make a decision. And I'm like, hey, I'll weigh it out. I'll get the consensus of the multitudes. I'll pray about it. I'll read scripture. And we've got to make a decision. Fire the gun and ride the bullet. I mean, let's go.
I like that. I like the fact that, I'm a guy who sees both sides of every coin. So if I make a decision, it ends up just mostly being a gut decision. Obviously, there's very black and white decisions, but I can see, you know, like the book I'm writing, right? I can see different perspectives of self-published versus a publisher, right? And so, like, you go back and forth, and, yeah, for me, sometimes some decisions are hard for me to make. But once I make it, I'm committed. I don't waver once it's done. It's just to get there sometimes takes me a while.
Yeah, if it did work out right, don't do it again. I mean, pivot, change, do something different. Great question.
Question four. In what situations brings out the best in Aaron?
Yeah, competitive. I love competition. It's like if we're going to fish, I'm going to beat you. If we're going to play golf, I'm going to win. People said, just go out there and relax and have fun. I'm not having fun unless I'm winning. So I'm competitive. There's not a bone in my body that's not competitive.
I can see you as the dad when your daughter tried to shoot a basketball. You just swatted the hell out of it.
Well, hey, as soon as she could shoot it over me, she could score.
Especially when my oldest was younger, I think the first child, and it's a boy, so it's a bit of a unique relationship you know, if you will, with you know, the father, son, first son. And I have said that I will beat my son at all costs as long as possible, because at one point I will be too old and he will be old enough. So well, until then,
I don't believe in every kid gets a trophy. That drives me out of my mind. You know, it's like, are you serious?
My wife got really mad at when we moved out here to the Middle East. I threw away a bunch of the medals. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is crap. Like, he got dead last in a race. What are we rewarding?
Right. Yeah. You know? You suck as an athlete. I
mean, yeah.
It shows, right? Yeah. I'm with you.
All right. So question five, at your funeral, what do you want people to say about you?
My life was better as having known you.
Oh, that's great. That's perfect. All right, well, that's Fast Five. Thanks a lot for playing.
I loved it. I loved it. That was good. Do I win an award? Do I get a trophy or something?
I will give you a virtual hug.
There you go. All right, man. It was cool. It was good.
All right, well, let's talk about your book that's coming out, A View from the Top, and, you know, where the idea comes from, what you're hoping to get out of it, the inspiration.
Yeah, thank you. I won't keep you but a minute on this because, you know, I don't want it to make it sound like just a promo for the book.
No,
but the
make it a promo. That's fine.
I poured my life, heart, and soul into this book for 2 years. I didn't even want to write it. And I'll tell you why I didn't want to. It was my pride had jumped up in front of me because guys I'm around, I mean, I told you earlier, one of the guys in our mastermind group wrote 115 books. I mean, the guy's written books for every noted person you've ever known. He's a ghostwriter, and I could call their names and you'd be like, oh my gosh. I'm like up against that. He sits next to me in a mastermind. Then Dave Ramsey sits on the other side, and his last book, he sold 5 million copies, and Dan Miller's got a dozen books. And I'm like, what if I write my book and it's terrible? What if nobody but my wife and 2 daughters buy it? Well, what's going to happen? And I made that comment one day in front of the mastermind group, and a guy named Ken Davis is in our mastermind. He wrote a book called Fully Alive, and it tells us how we should live every day being fully alive. And he said, Avery, I want to stop you right there. He said, 17 people have emailed me over the course of the past couple of years and told me that they didn't commit suicide as a result of reading my book. He goes, what measure are you measuring by to determine whether your book is successful? He said, what if one person reads this book and their family tree changes forever? Will it not be worth it? I went out of there on fire. I was like, give me my computer. I'm fixing to write this book. And I did. I poured myself into it for 2 years. Man, we were so fortunate at the people that we got to endorse this book. I mean, it's amazing. Guys that have been just so generous, like Ken Davis and Grant Baldwin and Daniel Lappin, Pat Flynn, Ray Edwards. The list goes on and on. Dave Ramsey, Ken Abraham, all these people got behind me and supported me and endorsed the book because some of the things that I talk about are similar to what we've already discussed about having that mindset of, you know, can't, couldn't do it. And I talk about the immeasurable rewards that are headed your way that you don't even know it yet. I talk about finishing when I was 27 years old and how I got fat and lazy and bored. I talk about breaking free, how you too can break free from those bondage. I talk about letting bitterness go because I was bitter at a point in time in my life, and that squelches our creativity. I'm telling you, man, bitterness will ruin you, and I tell you how to let go of bitterness. And then I tell you also about priorities, about the value of mastermind groups. I now facilitate 7 mastermind groups a week. I'm the facilitator, and it's called Iron Sharpens Iron. Just as iron sharpens iron, as one man sharpens another. And we get in there, and I mean, we go for it, like I talked about earlier in the interview. And I tell you the value of that. And there's one chapter in there titled, You Can't Handle the Truth. And I tell people, just as we said earlier, you need people around you to encourage you, to tell you the truth, to tell you things that you don't want to hear so you'll get better. So that's in essence what it's about. It's kind of a memoir. It's kind of telling my story. But then I give you actionable steps that you can take so that you too can have an indescribable view like I've got now a view from the top. We've just got to determine what that is for you.
Man, that was an unbelievable marketing swirl hurricane that just came through on that interview.
You know what's cool too? For the people that pre-order the book, and you can do it right now when you hear this. This is the part that I don't like, but I think it's kind of cool. It sounds like, oh, you've got to go buy this right now. But here's the thing, it's true, because this ends in just a couple of weeks. I wrote another book called The Mastermind Blueprint, and I teach people how to build mastermind groups. And Seth Godin gave me an endorsement. It's right on the front cover of the book. It's an incredible book. It's a great read. It helps you understand what masterminds are and how you can build your own. And then I did 5 interviews, just what you've just done with me, but I've done a video. And I've interviewed John Lee Dumas, Pat Flynn, Ray Edwards, Dan Miller, and Lee Cockrell. Lee Cockrell was the VP of operations for Disney for 10 years, $175 billion organization he ran for 10 years. There's a few nuggets in that interview. But I'm giving all that away. I'm giving every bit of it away with a pre-order of the book. And the place you get it is viewfromthetop.com/book. If you'll go there, fill it out, I'll send you the book along with 5 interviews and a copy of the Mastermind Blueprint.
Aaron, so I have, actually, I have 2 questions left and then I'll let you run. Can you describe to my audience what a mastermind group is? Because I honestly had no idea until I talked to you the first time on the phone.
Well, here's the thing. A mastermind group is kind of like your own board of directors. You get the same people you meet with every week. For us, it's men. And women do it. They're all over the country, everywhere they're doing it. We do it virtually. So we use what's called Zoom. It's kind of like Skype, but it's a different platform. 10 people come together. We have people all over the world that are participating in these groups. You meet with the same guys every single week. We have an accountability tool where you go in and you fill out this accountability tool every week, things you want to be held accountable for in your life, and we talk about that. We have what's called man in the middle, where Dr. James Kelly would come in here and say, hey, I got these 2 personal problems and I got a business problem, and what do you guys think? And you throw it out there and we discuss it, we get around you, because you only have one filter. You only have one life experience. You can only see things one way. That's all you can do. But when you have 10 people around you that are smart, now the IQ just became genius, because everybody is circling around you with a different vantage point, a different lens, a different perspective. And you're like, man, I didn't even know to know that. I had no idea. Then the resources that are there, the introductions, which, let me tell you something, your net worth is directly proportionate to your network. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a network, right, you're not going to be have what I'm talking about from any perspective, because you just don't know anybody. So these guys support, give you the resources, give you the introductions, hold you accountable, and they make you better. And that is a really quick overview of what masterminding is. I've been doing it 2 decades. I would never not have a mastermind group. Ever. They have saved me so many times, and I can point back to so many places that they have caused and created and helped me be successful in many arenas.
That's awesome. That's something that I definitely am interested in as an individual, because you know, I was talking to Mary, that's my wife, and you know, I think if you are a self-reflective individual, you get to a point, and you said this earlier, that you just can't solve the world's problems on your own. Like you can't figure out the best path forward for yourself sometimes, because as you pointed out, rightfully so, your own self-bias gets in the way of making probably a better choice. And so this is where I think these type of groups are super powerful. So
they're amazing. I'm telling you, it'll rock your world. It will change your life for the better, guaranteed 100%.
So this is my last question, Aaron. And I think you're going to end in a bang with this question. So I set the bar pretty high, so you better. All right. So, Aaron, how do you define happiness?
Well, there again, that's a choice. It's not a trait. And I elect to be content in every situation that I'm currently in. Now, am I unhappy at times? Well, absolutely. I'm carnal. I'm human, right? I mean, bad things happen to good people that you can't help. And I can't be happy over that. But I choose to look for happiness. I don't let other people dictate my life. I choose my life. I choose the way I look at things. I choose who I'm around. And it's easy to choose to be happy when your election from the beginning is to be that. If you looked at it the way your mom looked at it, you know, yeah, you could complain. And are things bad? Yes, it is. But if you elect for your glass to be half full instead of half empty, you'll have an amazing, amazing life. The other thing is there's two slogans that I have. I've already shared one of them with you. I've lived my life by that mantra. Is can't, couldn't do it, and could did it all. The second one is fear missing an opportunity more than you fear failure. And if you have that approach to life, you will excel beyond your wildest imagination.
Well, Aaron Walker, thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
It's been fun, Dr. Kelly. Have a good one, buddy.
You too. I just want you to know that I really appreciate everything you do. Please go to my website, drjameskelly.com, K-E-L-E-Y. Go to the book section, subscribe there. And if you want, you can help me review my book. Your insights, input, edits, all of it. So go there, be a part of the process. And if you're part of that process, I'll give you a free book when it comes out spring 18.